Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. The Sean Bell police shooting trial is now 2 weeks old. WNYC's Arun Venugopal has been in the courtroom as questions mount about prosecution witnesses who appear to help the defense. So we'll talk about some of the details that have come out this week. We'll also take phone calls from lawyers and anyone else in the legal system, judges, anyone else on what you think the prosecution is up to here. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Our phones are open now. And our comments page at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Good morning, Arun.
Good morning, Brian.
So a big issue in this case is whether one of the defendants identified himself as a police officer to Sean Bell or his passengers. And we have now heard some evidence on either side of that question. Can you first review why that is considered important to the question of guilt or innocence?
Well, these were undercovers that night. They were all trying to blend into the environment. Especially the officers who went into the club, who were walking outside after the night of partying inside. They were kind of trying to blend in with Bell and his friends. So the question is, once they turned that corner onto Liverpool Street, where the shooting finally occurred, did they clearly announce themselves to the men in the car, to Bell and his two friends? And were they visibly wearing badges that they could see from inside the car? Or did they just appear to be thugs who were descending on Bell at the last minute and, you know, who basically sort of started shooting at them without any warning?
Which would have induced Bell to maybe drive into their van or strike the one of them, Giscard is Nora?
Exactly. The phrase that's being used now on both sides, but was first, put out there by the defense is, the defense, of course, is saying is Nora did announce himself as a police officer very clearly. But what they said is these men, as in Sean Bell and his friends, what they saw, they just saw a Negro with the gun. It's a very heavy, loaded phrase. What they're trying to say is these men don't recognize authority, even if it's presented to them by somebody who happened to be black. That's is Nora in this case. He had a gun, yes, but he also had, you know, he clearly announced himself as a police officer. He did everything he had to do. That's what the defense says. But then you heard the family lawyers for Bell and his family and his friends who were saying, yeah, that's true. They did see essentially a Negro with a gun. They used the same phrase after court proceedings the other day. They're trying to reappropriate this and say, like, yeah, they just saw a guy who suddenly came out with a gun and started basically threatening them at the last second. So it's a very important question as to what exactly happened, whether he was wearing his badge, whether he announced himself properly with adequate warning or not.
And who testified to what regarding that question? Because there seems to be important testimony that indicates that he was not wearing a badge or trying to identify himself by shouting police, and some testimony that he was.
Yeah, you do have several officers who came to the scene after the shooting and who give varying accounts, which isn't necessarily very helpful because some of them say, well, I don't recall whether he was, which people who are on Bell's side, of course, say, yeah, see. But then again, you know, there are others who say, yes, he was. They were wearing the badges. Doesn't do much good if it's 45 minutes, an hour later or whatever. The two people who were there that night were Lieutenant Gary Napoli. He headed the undercover operation that night. He was in his car, a Camry, not too far away on the same block when the shooting broke out. And then there's undercover Hispolito Sanchez. He was inside the club throughout much of the night. He came out, was kind of walking with this group back towards, I guess, the cars to Liverpool Street. He wasn't on Liverpool Street. He was just around the corner when he heard the shooting. But he says that he heard, he could hear what sounded like commands right before the shooting, which is very helpful for the defense, which is saying, you know, look, that obviously sort of suggests that they did what they had to do, that the police did what they had to do. Now, as as Sanford Rubinstein, who's one of the lawyers for the Bell side, has said, is like, how can any person who can't actually make out the words that were said, which is what Sanchez admitted to, he couldn't hear any individual words, how can anybody actually say understand commands when he can't even hear, he wasn't close enough to hear the words? So I think that's, I personally think that, you know, the tenor, the tone of commands is distinct, even if it's separate from the words themselves. But, you know, it's obviously something that's going to play out further in this trial.
Now, jurors heard tape, which we will play now, of the 911 call made on the night of the shooting outside that Queens nightclub. And this is undercover Detective Hispolito Sanchez's call to emergency, and it paints a picture of confusion at first. Do you want to set this up for us?
Yeah, it's a long clip, but basically you have, I mean, the actual 911 call was long, but basically it's right as the shooting started happening. He calls. He had a backup phone that is Hispolito Sanchez. He calls the 911 operator, and here you have him desperately trying to figure out where he's located. You know, he just cannot give an address, and she keeps on prompting him. It takes a long time. He has to ask around. He has to ask Michael Oliver after the shooting's done. That's the other detective. You know, where are we? Where are we? But it clearly shows some disorientation on his part.
So here's about 20 seconds of that.
Injury. You say you need a bus. You need a bus for what?
Who's injured? The bus
for shots fired. Shots fired, but who's injured?
I don't have that information at this time.
You asked somebody just now for a location, 143rd place and what?
Then hello? So some confusion there in what he's trying to communicate. Then a few minutes later, a bit more information, but still plenty of unanswered questions.
So who's down? Is the MOS down?
No. Not,
MOS is not down.
MOS down?
Hello?
Yeah, right.
The MOS not down?
Okay, we got two perp shots.
We got two perp shots. Well, give me your address, sir. Two perp shot where?
Hold on one second, please.
Why was that so hard for him to give the dispatcher the address?
Well, what he's saying is, yes, we did discuss the club. This is prior to the operation. He said, well, it was discussed that we were going to go to possibly one of two clubs, and the Kahlua Club did come up, but what the prosecution is saying is that, you know, these guys were not very well prepared for this. They didn't even know exactly where they were headed. And so for him, it takes several minutes to actually identify where he just didn't know. He's looking everywhere for a sign. It's kind of an industrial area, so you don't really have, you know, the kind of signage, I suppose. I can't recall whether you have a sign at that corner or not, but it was dark, a lot of mayhem. So it's kind of lent itself to the prosecution's case. The other important issue, I think, that came out of that clip that you played was that at least the Bell side has really kind of been upset about is his use of the word two perps and, you know, perpetrators, as in describing Bell and his friends, which in a sense is sort of, they're saying it criminalizes them when they did nothing wrong, really. They really don't like the language that's being kind of thrown around there. But of course.
Right. Of course, in the heat of that moment,
yeah.
What this officer knows is it's not officers that were injured. It's the people the officers were engaging for whatever reason. So I guess his heat of the moment language is going to be perps.
Definitely, that's true.
The supervisor at the scene was Lieutenant Gary Napoli, who testified last week. He was in his car a few feet from the incident after ordering them to move in on Bell and his people. And he testified that he did not see the shooting begin because he was reaching down under the dashboard for a bubble light, the revolving red light, to put on top of his car. But yesterday, I gather, the existence of any such bubble light got called into question. What happened?
It's definitely something we're going to hear more about, but basically it was very sort of a low-key questioning. But as they were asking one of this crime scene investigators, they were asking about the inside of the car and the so-called bubble light, which did not materialize, but other little details, like there is apparently supposed to be a magnetic plate of sorts inside the car on the dashboard, and there wasn't anything like that either. So I don't know. I think we're going to hear more about this. You'll already see Napoli taking hits from, it sounds like, you know, the pro-police side. I don't know exactly what's going on, but definitely it sounds like there's some discrepancies in his account so far.
Why might he lie about something like the existence of a bubble light under the dash? What would that prove with regard to the officers on trial?
Well, it sounds like he was not being attentive in terms of being aware of what was happening on the street, just not too far away from him. Why he was distracted in any sense? If he wasn't ducking down to have a bubble light, then, you know, there's this word being thrown around about, you know, whether he was a coward or in some way just not basically rising up to the call of duty and getting his gun out and coming and helping his office fellow officers. So I don't know, but definitely his reputation is taking a battering these last couple weeks.
Certainly it is. I mean, Napoli is not a defendant in the case, but the prosecution is painting a picture of Napoli bungling his supervision of the job that night, contributing to the circumstances that led to the shooting. And beyond that, he's getting beaten up in the tabloids for allegedly being a coward. Where does that coward charge come from?
It comes from this whole, from two things. One, it comes from what was he actually doing during the shooting? And second, I think
down under the dashboard looking for this alleged bubble light.
Exactly. I mean, and if there is no bubble light, ultimately, and so far it looks like there's not, then what exactly was he doing? I mean, was he distracted in some manner? Or was he just basically, refusing to come out? He's a 50-year-old man. And right now, we know that basically, he suggested he might not have any career left in him at this point because he has internal investigations, I think, in the NYPD. And also he's kind of helped the prosecution by what we were talking about earlier, which is, did these police identify themselves or not? And he said he didn't hear any of that, in terms of saying police, stop, that kind of thing before the shooting, which is really, bad for the defense and for the reputation of the NYPD.
WNYC's Arun Venugopal with us. He's been attending the Sean Bell trial. And I do want to open up the phones for lawyers. We have maybe 10 minutes to take some calls, and I'd really like to hear from some lawyers today on what you think the prosecution is up to in terms of the big picture of how they're presenting this case, because it's raising questions in the press. It's raising questions among skeptics about DAs and their closeness with the police. Arun, you'll remember when you were on last week, it was only the end of the first week of the trial, and we were already talking about testimony by prosecution witnesses that seemed to help the defendants, and we already got a call from one listener wondering if the prosecution wasn't throwing the case because the DA's office is close to the police. And there was more prosecution testimony this week that could help the defense. The Times devotes its coverage today mostly to exploring this question, and the leading theory they come up with is that the prosecution is pursuing a just-the-facts strategy, putting everything on the table, the good and the bad, more like a public hearing than an advocacy presentation, no fire in the belly and the tone of voice, leave that for the defense, but to also get all the bad out so that the defense can't present it as an aha moment. And attorneys, if you're listening, what do you think is going on here? Prosecutors, former ADAs, there are a million former ADAs out there. Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Arun, give us some examples from this week of things that the prosecution brought out in its questioning of witnesses that may actually be seen as helping the defense.
Well, a lot of that comes from one man, that would be Detective Sanchez again, Hispolito Sanchez, who was inside the club, said it was just kind of this crazy, out-of-control atmosphere, kind of just men in heat, essentially drinking, groping, manhandling the women in there, and that there was apparently a couple guys who seemed to be armed, abuse, physical abuse of women, that kind of thing. But then the more important part is he comes outside. It's 4 a.m., 4:15 or so, and he is standing around as Sean Bell and Joe Guzman are apparently, according to him, getting into a standoff with another guy who they refer to as the man in black or the SUV guy because he had a black SUV parked right there. And he couldn't hear the exact words of the exchange, but it came down to Bell coming up and saying, "Let's F him up," and then Guzman saying, "Yo, go get my gun," a couple times. And so this is really, of course, quite useful for the defense. But then you have later on, of course, the part we talked about that he said that Isnora had been wearing his badge. This is 10 minutes after the shooting is over, after that phone call that you heard. But, a lot of time passes by, but it's very crucial. Did Isnora have his badge out? He said it was very visibly displayed around his upper lapel area, I guess, you know, just perfect for a driver in a car to have seen. So, but a couple of crucial things right there.
So let's take a phone call. Anthony in Manhattan, you say you're a former ADA?
Yes.
Thanks for calling in.
My impression is that the office, the district attorney's office is playing it down the middle. They're not there to hang the police out to dry, and they're not there to put on a defense. They're just going to lay the facts out and let the chips fall where they may.
Well, that may be the job of a grand jury, of a DA in front of a grand jury, but is that really the job of a DA, of a prosecutor in front of a judge in a trial?
Well, I think you know the answer. The answer is no, that's not their job. But you have to realize that day in and day out, they work with the NYPD, and there is no other way around it. They're not going to go out there and advocate a crucifixion of these officers.
But you're making a very serious charge, which is that the prosecution is not doing what it's supposed to do under the law, which is advocate for the conviction of the defendants.
Well, I think that's the reality. If you want to see that, I think there should have been a special prosecutor appointed, and possibly someone comes down from upstate New York or somewhere else and investigates and puts on the trial.
Mm-hmm.
But
Anthony,
expect somebody locally that within days of this trial has to cooperate with the NYPD, needs their cooperation. Possibly look some of these officers or detectives in the face. I think you're asking for too much.
Anthony, thank you for your call. Robert in Manhattanville, you're on WNYC. You're an attorney, Robert?
Yes, I am. I've done trials, mostly civil now. Early in my career, I did criminal.
Mm-hmm.
I think the key fact here is that it's a judge trial, not a jury trial. And I think that a room should be looking at how does the judge react to evidentiary rulings and objections to see if you can discern anything about how he views the cases. I think when it's a judge trial, there are less histrionics. There's far more emphasis on allowing the judge to see the evidence against the tableau of the law. And also, you have to remember that the prosecutors may be thinking, in that regard, we'll get a conviction on one of the lesser included offenses. And that's a sure thing. We overcharge because that's what prosecutors do. And hence, this judge is going to be like a super convening, not a grand jury, but like a congressional investigation. He'll look at all the evidence, and he will take his time and find all the facts because he's a judge.
So your theory here is that perhaps because it's a judge and not a jury, the prosecution is presenting in this kind of way, so I'm going to put words in your mouth now, so that it doesn't look like they're up to any tricks?
No, I wouldn't put it that way. It's not tricks. It's a way of deciding how we're going to win. It's tricks only in the art of the lawyer. It's
mm-hmm.
not tricks in an objective sense.
I understand. Robert, thank you very much. And Arun, he did have a question for you in there, which is, are you getting any indications from the judge, and again, this is a trial by judge, not a trial by jury, that he is perceiving the evidence in any way or setting certain bounds on what can be included, what can be excluded, et cetera, et cetera?
I have been trying to pay attention to that the last few days, and I mean, my sense is it's been fairly expansive. He has been allowing more rather than less, but it's, you know, I think that there's a lot of time left to really look at that. So it's something I'll definitely be paying more attention to, I think, over the next several weeks.
All right. Vanessa in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Vanessa. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks. I just want to say that the job of the government lawyer is always to do justice, always, in every circumstance. It's not about being a partisan for one particular result. You want to present all of the evidence, and you want to make sure that the decision maker understands what information is available. I have to confess, it doesn't always happen in every case on the part of the district attorneys, and when it doesn't happen, it's rightly criticized that the DA is trying to get a result rather than do justice. But prosecutors have a luxury no other lawyer has. Our client is only the state, the people, and justice. That's all we're supposed to do.
But once an indictment is brought, isn't the job of the DA? I mean, think Rudy Giuliani.
No.
Think Elliot Spitzer. Think,
please,
you know, all the
fictional stuff. Please, I'd rather not. That's not to say you don't zealously try. I mean, if you believe and if the evidence supports that a certain result is correct, a certain result is just, but let's say you're in the middle of a trial and you find exculpatory evidence that demonstrates the defendant is not, in fact, guilty. Your job at that point is to pull the whole thing, stop the action, and dismiss the case. So it's not about a result. The people always win when justice is done.
Do you agree with the other former ADA who called that the relationship is so close between the district attorney's office and the police, and the DA needs the police in so many cases?
Desperately. You need the police at all times desperately, and yes, I totally agree.
They may be playing it down the middle, as he put it, rather than advocating for a conviction, not out of this, you know, sense of the duty to justice, as you were describing, but for their own, you know, future convictions on future things, and that only a special prosecutor could really prosecute this case aggressively.
I think in most instances it would be very advisable for a special prosecutor to come into the picture when law enforcement or government officials are the defendants. I think that's entirely correct. I think that whether it's conscious or whether it's just unconscious, you work with the officers day in and day out. They are so, it's such a seamless, incestuous relationship of, and as you say, of great dependence. If cops decide to freeze you out, you're dead meat as the prosecutor. So that may well be an operative factor. I certainly can't say that about this particular case.
Right.
It's definitely something to be concerned about and so forth. But just because exculpatory evidence is being presented by a prosecution witness, I, as I say, I wish that would happen in every case. I wish that DAs would always be trying to draw out all of the information.
But is it in the real world very rare?
Yeah.
Vanessa, thank you for your call. Arun, before you go, two quick things. One, Juan Gonzalez's column in the Daily News today is about the testimony of Detective David Rivera, who collected evidence at the scene for 17 hours after the incident. One point was that bullets were found down the block and that Trent Benefield, one of those shot, may have been shot while trying to run away from the gunfire. At least that's Juan's implication. He was captured after running away, and Detective Rivera testified that Benefield had bullet holes in both the front and the back of his jeans. What's the significance of that?
Well, I mean, the police have said earlier, of course, that they recognize Trent Benefield running away as an unarmed man, so it's going to be a very important question to see whether, whether their accounts are challenged by, you know, by the fact that perhaps he was shot running away. I think, you know, these bullets, that they've been going through this, it's just kind of excruciating detail in terms of every single shell that was found in the vicinity. And, yeah, some of them were found far away in some pretty scary places, you know, going through windows and into people's living rooms and lamps and various cars down the block, that kind of a thing. What the defense is trying to do now is trying to sort of undermine the integrity of these crime scene investigators, or at least of the people who handled the crime scene that day itself, by saying, you know, what a sloppy job they did, their ambulance backing over, you know, over the street, perhaps dispersing evidence. I mean, you see shattered glass in strange places on the block. You see these bullets, like I said. They were trying to basically, challenge a detective who was inside the car, Sean Bell's car, gathering evidence and saying, you know, that basically you might have cross-contaminated blood and that kind of a thing. And so this is what they're trying right now already. They're trying to get ahead of that particular story. I'm not sure how effective how effective it will be, though.
30 seconds. The trial's off today. What do you expect next week?
I think we're in for the long haul. My sense is that I don't know yet who is going to be testifying, but I think we're going to have more of this crime scene investigation that's happening. This David Rivera who's doing yesterday, there's going to be more of the same. This is going to be a very long trial. We're going to have weeks of some pretty dense testimony, and before we get back to some of the star witnesses, the victims, and perhaps the the officers themselves.
So you'll be spending some time on the Brian Lehrer Show, if it's okay, bringing the listeners up to date. Arun Venugopal covering the Sean Bell police shooting trial for WNYC. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will get the latest, and there is some breaking news this morning on the Times Square bombing. Stay with us.